Malloy here. Time for another story, and another trip through the Wind Door. Listeners, I'd like to welcome you to a brand new episode, or half episode as these things have been going, of the New Century Fan Podcast, Through the Wind Door. Although, to be honest, I really need to come up with punchier intro and outro lines for our brand. Okay, some real talk, people. We knew this was going to be a tough podcast to promote, given it's a fan cast of a niche self-published series, but we're really not doing the volume we wish we were. So, in order to keep the lights on here at Century Productions, we're going to have to find ways to offset costs. Therefore, I am proud to let people know that we are now accepting sponsorship deals. Toby, would you like to introduce today's sponsor?
This podcast is sponsored by VoxTubes. If you're being beset by Wendigos, they are the best bet for how to make a good, juicy novel out of it.
Yeah, well, look, we're running this on no budget, so we have to make our money somehow.
Arlington's giving us some of that government grant money.
But no, hold on a second. He doesn't actually have money to give us. He only has RSA scrip. So we can only exchange that for things that the RSA can produce. I don't know.
I think he might have been lying to me.
If we're front-loading listeners all this humor into the beginning of the podcast, there's a reason for it. I'm not going to say that this episode is going to be more serious or less fun than the previous. Obviously, we found our way to enjoy even that, as we always do. Mm-hmm. But we are going to be covering tricky and different ground today, because first we have to tackle the enormous elephant of use of racial slurs, or more specifically, the N-word. And even by the standards of racial slurs, that's kind of one of the most verboten words of all. Long before people started calling a word that denigrates disabled people the R-word, or before people started using the C word in place of even referring to how men like to use the curse word, this particular word was only the province of black people to use without offense. And honestly, even then it was still problematic. I like Chris Rock as much as the next person, and am ashamed now of the way I would used to do one of his most famous stand-up routines that uses that word, even with the permission of the black coworker that enjoyed hearing my imitation. All that aside, one should never use this word lightly, let alone say it. But from there, even though the following chapters, which I don't think I even mentioned, we're doing chapters 14 through 17 of Secret Rooms today, the focus of these chapters is Abigail and James, and telling more about the role that Lucy played in their childhood and their formative, not years, in this case it's months, but it can't help therefore talking some more about the prominent mentor figure of Catherine Holloway. And in reviewing these chapters and having the thoughts that I did and then sending them on Toby's way, we came to some potential conclusions that we want to discuss in greater detail that may seem less charitable to someone that is essentially meant to be a hero of the New Century multiverse. But, you know, we couldn't do our jobs if we weren't willing to start talking about the things that troubled us about parts of the narrative that Alex intended. Catherine is meant to be this figure that is doing her best under the worst of circumstances, and we're going to get into the ways we feel that she kind of fell down on the job. to be clear, this is not going to be so much a critique of Alex's writing or philosophy, but more some of the unfortunate implications of the way things play out, due in part to narrative necessity. I'm not going to spoil the consensus we eventually come to, as that's putting the cart before the horse, and the nag has enough biting things to say about us as it is. But I will say that while we have had plenty of back and forth in the show notes, the conversation itself has to play out before we can give our honest opinions and bring a resolution to the concerns that I brought up during the planning stages.
Yeah, we're going to be putting her, sort of, who she is in these chapters under scrutiny, because I think that's the best way to lead to some, like, the best analysis we can provide. But I think it will also result in some conversations about how much of this is something that would be intentional versus something that might actually be a bit of an oversight on her as this mentor figure. And I think it is important to see what level of responsibility she actually employs in these with these events.
That's the biggest topic that we have to discuss. So let's begin by talking about some of the smaller topics that these chapters...
And I want to interject, smaller in terms of the length of time we might spend discussing them, but by no means less significant, as some of these topics have very widespread ramifications, and we will be looking at their application and their place in these chapters. But as we've made plain a number of times beforehand, we are doing our best to examine and discuss them within this sphere, but it is by no means the end of the conversation.
Yeah. No, I mean, if it were the end of the conversation, then we wouldn't be having a fan podcast, because Alex would just go on to do as he had done and have his round tables and tell everybody X means X and Y means Y, and there's no room for any further interpretation, and that's simply not the case.
Art accomplished. Meaning has been ascribed. Move on to new art.
Yeah. All right. So something we've gotten away from in previous episodes is doing a regular synopsis of the sequence of events.
Okay, Greg, tell me what pleasant events happen in this week's group of chapters.
In brief, the chapter 14 is meant to directly mirror some of the events that happened in chapter 13, because after having a very difficult conversation with Mary Sampson, we now end up having a very difficult altercation with Nathan, one of Catherine's staff there at Weirwood. For those of you that might have forgotten about Nathan, he's the reason some of the adults took their kids off the wagon in Clearwater, because it was being driven by a black man. And the way that certain young people chose to express themselves to Nathan...
Dissatisfaction? Yeah,
dissatisfaction.
I'm sure it was done in a very respectable and socially conscious way, right?
Yeah, and that's why... At the end of the chapter, Abigail chases her down and tries to punch her. Or successfully does punch her, now that I think of it, yeah.
It's square in the face.
That's part of her brand. So that happens, and as part of the surrounding dynamic, we discover that Abigail, James, and Lucy have become very close to each other in the intervening months between this flashback and the flashback, or really just the opening of the definitive edition of Secret Rooms. It's been about 3 months, and they are part of their own little circle now, where they choose to interact with each other and not many other people, which is part of the reason why things get as intense as they do, because they may not have considered Nathan part of their circle right up until that point. I mean, he is a member of staff rather than being a child their own age. But the point is that when James and Abigail are confronted with the stark harassment of Nathan, Abigail goes off half-cocked, wanting someone to blame and punish, and James follows along in her wake, wanting to use his skills to assist. Both of them very much play into type, even as Lucy herself stays behind and does the same, wanting to provide empathy and companionship to Nathan, since hers is definitely not a confrontational nature. Investigation happens, accusations are made, people are run down, and at the end of it, Catherine is just generally very unhappy. And because this emotional situation flourishes from there into James and Lucy having an intimate moment that Abigail is excluded from, not necessarily intentionally, but after being chewed at by Catherine, she's all riled up, where all of a sudden she no longer feels at home anywhere, because Lucy and James were her home, and that has been taken from her. Through no one's fault. These are kids. They're having an emotional moment, and were they together, then they could have all been part of that. Abigail reacts the way she does. She wants to leave at this point, and Catherine refuses to let that happen because, as she so succinctly put it, you're on an island surrounded by sharks. I'm not allowed to murder you. Which she would consider letting her travel out on her own being, and not necessarily wrongly in that assertion.
It is interesting, her wording here, and I think we'll get into this, and don't worry, this isn't another one of our on-brand, we'll get to that later isms, where we don't actually get to that later. We'll get to it when we reach the main talking point of this episode, which is Catherine and her role as the overseer and caretaker of these children, because she does say it as, I'm not allowed to murder you, and it being a question of whether she's allowed to or not, it's not her saying, I don't want to murder you, it sort of shows that there is this descending system of authority and responsibility, that she still believes that there will be some higher authority than just her as the leader of this small society of people trying to survive the Wendigo. She still believes that there will be a higher authority that she will have to answer to when the government takes action and they all re-enter America.
Toby talks about higher authority here, which could be ascribed to the government or even the parents whom she promised that she would keep their charges safe. But there's a further interpretation you'll get to hear from the voice actress herself, as I release concurrently with this episode our interview of Maya Santandrea and her experience of voicing Catherine Holloway, among others.
But it also is a way of emphasizing to Abigail that this responsibility and fitting within these things is important. So she is not allowed to murder her, and Abigail has rules that she needs to follow as well.
That's actually an unusual way of putting it. I hadn't necessarily considered that, primarily because, as she put it earlier in the book, she has no idea when authorities will show up. I assumed that when she was using the word allowed, she was using the context of Abigail's words just previously. But that's fine. It's definitely something worth considering. But I, as much as I can say about Catherine, I would qualify her as being a generally moral person. So therefore, the idea of not wanting to risk losing even one person due to teenage emotional outburst as being an empathetic response on her part rather than simply a duty response on her part. But then again, she did already promise to all of those parents and to Abigail's mother specifically that she would take care of them. So exactly. I guess you're right. She does have a duty that is self-imposed on her above and beyond anybody else present at Weirwood.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, well done. Thank you. What follows all of this drama is Lucy having a panic attack that James assists her through, But in the days and weeks after, the closeness of all three does not repair entirely. James catches Lucy and Abigail together in a similar fashion, and responds in a manner once more in keeping with his internal self, deciding to absent himself from that circle, defaulting to logic and learning, rather than the growth of emotional connection. For a while, this means that we get an insight into what it means to be queer during this particular part of American culture. It's made all the more complicated by the fact that the only culture that exists is the small amount of it that is a part of Weirwood. There is no indication that anybody else knows about what happened between Lucy and Abigail. They did a very good job of keeping it secret, except for James, of course, who was present during some of those more intimate moments. And it allows for them to explore this idea a little bit, but they don't end up getting too deep into it because they discover very quickly that the two of them are not the only people that Lucy has strong emotional resonance with. The quirkily referred to Stonewall Jackson suddenly comes back into the picture as we find that there is a letter that has been left by Lucy for him, that they have made contact somehow, and she is planning on running off into the night with him because she feels a duty to live up to the pledge that they made to each other long before any of this current circumstance happened. On top of everything else, what is influencing Lucy is possibly not unlike the very thing that Catherine herself talks about in her story of Weirwood. Longtime fans will be familiar with that story, but because that portion of her story is not in the Secret Room's audio drama, the short of it is that she pledged to marry a Confederate soldier who came back from war both mentally and physically scarred. And in her own words,
"I did what so many other Southern ladies at the time were prone to do. I stood by him. The Yankees had taken so much from us that to let my determination waver in the ugly face of cold consequence would have meant their victory over my soul." That August we were married.
And Lucy is also the sort of person who clearly is capable of feeling an intense love for more than just one person. For as much as she does not show any hesitancy to exploring what she and Abigail share, I think that she doesn't quite know how to handle her feelings for more than one people. The idea of polyamorous relationships working is something that they don't really explore, like partly because I think, you know, it's complicated enough for them to navigate it at their young age with just, you know, one relationship at a time. To explore it between the three of them all at once, or even the four of them with this new fiance, is something that is never really considered or presented as a possibility. And I think Lucy is clearly not doing this without any shred of regret. I forget the exact wording here, but when she's asked if going away with her previous fiancé is what she wants, she says, "It's not the only thing I want, but I can't have everything." A lot of fiction that deals with young love often explores the idea of the tragedy of young love is often when it's not given the chance to actually run its course naturally, and for the people involved to actually have the chance to come to terms or find a way to make it work or have the experience from a lifetime worth of interacting with other people. And in these circumstances, for this particular time period and the social system of America coming down, and there's just so many factors at play which mean that Lucy cannot even comprehend of a way for her to have everything that she wants. She just accepts that she has to choose one of them and come to terms with the fact that she cannot pursue everything else that she wants.
Yeah, we've gotten away from the synopsis at this point, but this is one of the
That's my role. Greg, you're the responsible one. I just try to deep dive into themes and take us off course at the first opportunity.
Yeah, but I don't want to interrupt you because then I feel like I'm talking too much. as it turns out, after having pointed out that we were getting in the way of the synopsis, I apparently just decided to give up on it altogether. As you'll notice in later episodes, the plan is basically to just try and talk about the subjects we want to address in as close to story timeline order as we can. After all, the assumption of these regular episodes is to talk about the things we found significant in the chapters we're covering that day. We're not here to retell the story, or to merely say, this moment happened in the story and it was good. And we assume our audience is already familiar with the events, or why would they be listening? We do enough clarification when we highlight moments in the story ripe for discussion and analysis. As long as we keep to our outline, we're less likely to feel discombobulated. One of the things that I wanted to bring up as a result of these four chapters is if the story of Lucy, James, and Abigail work as a good example for both non-traditional sexuality as well as non-traditional relationships. One of the conclusions that I came to is that I feel like it works on an LGBTQ level, because trying to figure these things out at a formative age, this is how this works. It's normal for people to be questioning and to be figuring these things out when they're young and the hormones are going and they're having new experiences and don't necessarily yet know how to parse and translate and understand who they are on a relationship and sexual level, which are two very different things. And Alex, I think, does a good job of exploring that in a limited fashion. James's acceptance of it speaks very well from an author avatar sense. But on the subject of polyamory, as you went into a moment ago, what it talks about here is how even among adults, that kind of complicated relationship fails when communication breaks down. This has been a secret that Lucy has been keeping to herself for a very long time. Maybe she had no idea if she would, in fact, ever see the eponymous Stonewall Jackson again. Not actually eponymous. That's not his name. That's just the code word that was given when Lucy was referring to him. But it's just as well that that story falls apart, at least from a polyamory level, because diving too deep into that, you start talking about potential sexual relations between underage participants, and that's that's a dicey subject under the best of circumstances. Best to just leave it all in the realm of the theoretical.
Yeah, we're not Stephen King here. That's just, nope.
God, no.
Nope.
I remember one of my arguments many years ago after reading the Hunger Games trilogy was that it was utterly flummoxing to me that there were romance elements and never any sexual elements. I found that entirely unlikely given teenage proclivities, and at the time, I was still a huge Buffy fan. It's only now, after years of learning and better understanding the disturbing tendency to sexualize teenagers in media and how problematic that is, that I can look back at past me and say, dude, what the hell? Having said that,
Greg,
actually, what?
I am concerned with a having said that a leading on from the previous subject matter.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not actually getting into that part of things. But something that occurred to me only just within the last couple of days when we've been going over these talking points is that this story started with a Poe reference. And that means that although we have not gotten to the important edifice of secret rooms yet, this is actually still Gothic fiction.
Yes.
So therefore, the complicated relationship between Lucy and James and Abigail and this now this fourth other person, that's the romance part of Gothic romance. It's just And the tragedy is now already baked in, because as the final chapter comes to a close, it is implied that Lucy's paramour is dead, and that Lucy herself has become a Wendigo, and everyone is shocked to the core when Catherine has to stride forward and put a bullet in Lucy's head. I mean, the tragedy has already happened. It's just the final exclamation point that sets the tone for this is now the tragedy of Abigail and James's lives, that they made these choices when they were kids for the best of reasons, but also for emotional reasons. And it led not only to Catherine sequestering the two of them, so they couldn't even try to rebuild something in the wake of one of their number now gone, but it's the reason why the story begins with, even though we aren't really friends anymore. Obviously, I've already referenced the Gothic roots present in the story in past episodes, but as recorded, this is the moment that I started really seeing them, and the Gothic aspects from this point will be discussed in more detail during both the chapter coverage and our finale.
I'm just letting all of that wash over me for a moment.
Yeah. There is more to talk about on this particular subject, but that is best saved for another day as more context comes to light. So let's talk about something just as bittersweet, but a little lighter in topic. Way back when we first started discussing the opening chapters, the original opening chapters of Secret Rooms, where James is having his conversation with Frank Butler. And James has made the decision, yes, okay, I'm going to become a cartographer, going to join the RSA. One moment, please. Do you happen to have a bag of humbugs on you? And we posited at the time that when he was having a response to the flavor of the humbugs, that based on the chapters we just read previously, that the memory he was having was either having humbugs as a kid, or perhaps more specifically the peppermint tea that his mother used to drink. Now, having read these chapters, I realize that I was completely off base, or that I was at the very least not quite hitting the mark, because when James and Lucy kiss, he tastes peppermint oil on her lips.
Oh, and the tragedy.
Yes, the feels that just washed over the two of us when we made that connection. That was, yeah, no, I don't have anything else to say about that. They never go into why it is that she would have peppermint oil on her lips, but given the important foundation of that moment, and that he was now going to be heading off into the wider world with Abigail, it makes sense that that sense memory might come over him particularly strongly, even if he doesn't necessarily remember why.
While there may be a difficulty in establishing the logical reason why she has peppermint oil on her lips, I think that that scent fits with Lucy and James's perception of Lucy, in that she is this breath of fresh air for both Abigail and James, that we will talk later about how she acts as the connective tissue between the two, and as a result she's this thing that kind of makes everything feel right and fresh, and so there it's kind of the symbol of her vitality. But more significant than that, when you pointed out not only this but the connection to James's mother, it suddenly occurred to me that all three of the things that the peppermint oil reminds James of, which is Lucy, his mother, and possibly even his childhood in England with the humbugs and the sweets there, all three of those things are lost to the adult James. They are all things that were associated with pleasant memories, but they are gone. It's a sweet smell to him because, like all fresh things, it is ephemeral, momentary, before dissipating and being lost. Yet those fleeting moments stay, lingering and haunting him forever.
Yeah, I think the haunting him forever part is important, because that scene where he has the emotional reaction to Peppermint has already just established he doesn't forget things. Or, at the very least, it's very hard for him to forget things.
Yes, because he remembers the details, he logs them, and so he will always be analyzing not just the things around him, but his whole database of memories that he will reflect on, and it helps him to, like any computer or like any human, he takes in experiences and learns from them, and that's what makes him, leads him to the decisions he makes later in life. So he will always be able to play the moment of Lucy's death, both the moment that she was shot through the head and that moment where she gave them one last smile and then turned her head and was gone forever, and his decision had been made that would lead to her death. He will never forget that.
Okay, that's a very depressing thought. Let's move on to something more cheery. The N-word.
Oh, I was about to take a sip of a drink just there, and honestly, I'm glad I didn't, because that would have been a spit take.
Yeah.
And I don't think that sounds particularly good on audio.
No, it would be far more impressive if we were doing this on YouTube, and at which point I would actually just, you know, let the camera run, maybe show it a couple of times, and then play it out in slow motion.
Okay, we're doing everything we can to avoid talking about this, aren't we?
it's something that it's difficult to talk about even... I don't know if there is a best of times to be discussing this sort of thing. Originally, we were hoping to have Eric Jones come on to help put this into some greater context, because obviously this first chapter in particular focuses hard on the character that he voices, Nathan. Mm-hmm. And the things that he has to say on the subject are important because they are still resonant today. What I meant here was what Nathan has to say in the story about the behavior of white people, particularly scared white people. And as before, we were recording on this topic still before the killing of George Floyd. Our inability to talk to Eric was due to a personal tragedy, and not the explosion of a fresh wave of police violence. I'd like to say that when these topics come up again for Cartographer's Handbook in Arlington, that we might be able to have a black voice on the podcast, and our country will be working towards fixing the damage from the last 5 years. I'd like to say that. Just briefly broaching the topic itself that leads into a deeper discussion of Nathan. If there's one thing that I appreciate with the way Alex has chosen to include this part of quote-unquote history into his story, if I'm recalling it correctly, I mean, obviously we've read the chapter here, but the word does make its appearance known in the Cartographer's Handbook as well. But it is used once here, and also in the Cartographer's Handbook, it's used three times. Twice in historical journal entries, and once in Arlington's own autobiographical account. But that's a story for another time. Well, here it's used as not background precisely, but the point is that even when Alex has to speak the word himself, being the narrator, it is not one person speaking to another. It is a scrawl on a wall that is meant to be accusatory and intimidating and whatever else Doris meant to do with this particular act of rebelliousness or just racial hatred, because she has been infected with the evil opinions of her father that the Wendigos are a result of, I don't even remember now, racial impurity or the fact that the slaves were freed, or the reason almost doesn't even matter because it's bullshit. And going forward, Alex finds other ways to make insulting comments from hateful people without resorting to that word. It's already complicated enough that he is a white man voicing a black protagonist, without doubling down on using the N-word conversationally in further New Century stories. He never uses that word again. The point has been made. We don't need to roll around further into it.
Yeah.
The content itself speaks for what it is.
Does that never actually come up in Arlington?
It's entirely possible that I might have blocked it out, but I don't think so.
Understandable.
Yeah. it's like, I'm pretty sure that I remembered that it was going to be something we were eventually going to cover in Secret Rooms and Cartographer's Handbook. But when we finally get someone that is an out-and-out bigot and dangerous, unlike Mayor Buck, he uses everything. He uses the entire kitchen sink, but not the N-word.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll find out that I'm wrong, because I've forgotten so many other things along the way.
Well, I think the point of, like, the point still stands that it is such, it is used with such scarcity throughout this entire series that we can't be sure. I think that should reflect the fact that it is not used excessively. And that leads on to my point, which is that use of this word in any context is going to be a hard subject to talk about. And it's a word that no decent person should ever want to utter, let alone, as you point out, call another person. It's the calling another person that makes it truly reprehensible. In storytelling, the deployment of that word is a tightrope, and I think the first hurdle that comes up is overuse of the word, and that's something you should definitely avoid. The reason for that is because if you use it excessively, then it could inadvertently, and I'm saying inadvertently to give the author the benefit of the doubt and hoping they would never want to intentionally do this, you would normalize its usage. And that's why I have mixed feelings on Django Unchained, Quentin Tarantino's just using it like with the rapidity of a machine gun, and it just feels like by the end of the film I winced every time I heard it, but the fact that it's lost any of its sting feels like something that shouldn't really happen. Admittedly, the word has been repurposed for like some black people who have adapted its utterance into something new that strips it of its negative power, or at least allows them to claim ownership of it, though even commenting on this subject to this extent is something that I, a very pasty, white, British nerd, really don't want to mishandle or represent the significance of the word being adapted into new meanings in some black communities. So my point is that Alex doesn't normalize it. When it is uttered, it is done sparingly and it draws attention to itself and the character of the person who speaks it, writes it, or invokes the term. And I think that that is a responsible approach to handling it. But the ethics of using the term at all are a heavy and intricate subject, rightly so. It's always going to be the prerogative of each individual reader and listener whether they accept an author's handling of the term. So if any listener or any person who would discover this work in the future, like, read it, listened to it, and they felt it, they objected to it, I don't think I would be able to argue with them. It is their prerogative whether they accept the application of such a term.
I even heard a low groan in the background as you were talking, suggesting that the Wendigo agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they'll eat your face off, but, like, they're gonna be, like, if like, I've done experiments. I think they go after people who use that word first, so, you know.
At time of editing, the big new hotness is Lovecraft Country, an HBO series with a cast of all-black protagonists during the Jim Crow era, complete with a black showrunner, Misha Green. I've watched several episodes of it so far, but I couldn't tell you how often the N-word is invoked, aside from a memorable moment when referencing an infamous H.P. Lovecraft poem. Responses are mixed, even among black audiences. But at the very least, it is a black-focused story, giving them agency. And yet at the same time, the very recently released movie Antebellum has been quoted as having far too much black suffering without purpose on screen. If we live in a world where microaggressions are finally acknowledged as real, then the N-word might be a macroaggression, no less an assault than an actual physical blow. And white people should never forget that. Well, that dovetails nicely into Nathan's story, because one of the things that he actually mentions when he is talking about his experience with white people and how he considers the tarred epithet on his house wall, or his shack wall, I guess, is the more adequate way of phrasing it. And he's, compared to what he's experienced, he says, this is just white people being stupid and scared. But on top of that, he goes on to open himself up a very little to the three of them as they are trying to figure out what to do and trying to circle the wagons around Nathan for various reasons. And he's talking about how he's never going to feel truly safe around white people. And this is in 1883. Here we've got a little bit more of the resonance to modern events, where in 2020, where police kill black people on the slightest whim, where this is somehow managing to go on even during quarantine. I don't want to discuss that because it feels like I'm on some level fetishizing the pain of black people by even bringing up the subject. But yeah, the whole thing with police brutality, police lethality, white people calling the cops on black people, that hasn't changed at all. It's just we have a very small place in Weirwood where one person feels free to voice their opinion, even if they're doing so behind the safety of secrecy, you know, just like someone might do that on the internet where you can never be certain who anybody is. And so, yeah, we have natural empathy for Nathan, but when he's speaking here, he's also talking about the fact that, particularly beyond this one point, later on, where Abigail is attempting to get to know him better, and he doesn't open up nearly as much as he did in this one chapter. It speaks of his natural distrust on being vulnerable to white people and white voices. Just because Abigail has the opportunity to interact with Nathan, it doesn't mean that she's more prepared for dealing with Mary. It's here that the ongoing protests post-George Floyd and Breonna Taylor lend additional meaning to this moment. During the early days of the BLM protests, black leaders were trying to curtail the rising instigation of white protesters. Some of the rioting bullshit may well have been undercover cops or white supremacists trying to escalate matters. But the added crux of it is that if white people did this, then it would be black people that would suffer the most because of it. White privilege would ensure that white criminal acts would not be punished as severely, same as it ever was. In secret rooms, Abigail went off half-cocked because that's what she does. It's not unfathomable to think that Nathan might have felt less safe around her, not because he feared her, but because he feared how other people might try to punish him for her getting them in trouble. This story is still about Abigail and James, so let's come back to them. And more specifically, the now put into perspective relationship with Lucy that had only been name-checked in the original chapters, and we got to see a little of her during the first flashback that was added, but that was still just introducing the three of them together and the way they reacted to stress and learning about Weirwood, exploring it together with Lucy, of course, being the one that was most knowledgeable, having been there longer. It's notable that of the three of them, Lucy also happens to be the most socialized. James is isolated due to privilege, family choices, and likely being neurodivergent also plays into that. And even though Abigail grew up in a more open community, her rebellious nature, and perhaps her mother's past, affected her ability to make social connections as well. And now, 4 months later, 4 months, not 3 months, apparently, even though they have had the opportunity to interact with other people, they chose to spend all of this time together and they imprint on each other. So when they are first broken up by the complicated feelings, and then later by Catherine herself, in part due to the death of Lucy, it has devastating effects. James, who has already had difficulty making connections, becomes utterly dedicated to his work, and socializing with people is a distant fourth. This is part of the reason why his rapport with Butler is as significant as it is. It's probably one of the few times that he's actually had a non-work conversation in years. Abigail, meanwhile, managed to open herself back up to others. When we get to her first journal entry, she speaks of all of the people that she would miss back in Weirwood. She's better at making connections, more like Annie, which is part of the reason why there is a specific resonance between the two of them, as well as some butting of heads. But now both of them have grown into adults much the same as they were as kids. On a fundamental level, little has changed. While this may have assisted them in being functional, assisted them in their survival, it feels like it has harmed their growth as people. This is part of the reason why their first experience as part of the wider world is as rocky as it is. In these chapters, James says it himself, once Lucy and Abigail are rent from him, he is no longer a whole person. Way back in our first Secret Rooms episode, we discussed how James repudiated the toxic advice of his father. James worked so hard with the help of Catherine and Lucy and Abigail to make the connections that his father would have described as weakness. But in the end, his father's words seem to have had their day after all, because he does set himself apart from others as a result of Lucy's death. After all, how can he be a good doctor, be the best of men, if he allows something that causes this much internal turmoil into his life to affect his work? And Abigail likewise has her moment where Lucy is shot down and she can't cry and she asks herself, am I broken? On further consideration, those early moments in Abigail's story also have a resonance to Lucy's death. Her mother tells her that there is going to be a problem she can't punch, and the obvious parallel to draw is that her interaction with Mary Sampson is that problem. Revisiting this moment and our words on it, however, it's clear that the answer is even simpler than that, especially since these chapters were initially written with the earlier chapters in mind. This is the original problem that Abigail cannot punch. She couldn't use violence to make Lucy stay, and she couldn't use it to deal with her grief or the loss of James.
I don't want to misuse any professional terms, but it feels like from the way you've laid all of this down, that they've both been through some form of arrested development where they were going along their paths, and now that, as you say, they've stuck to who they were and just kind of grown into bigger versions of themselves as adults. And I think that with Werewood, it's a success story in many ways, because they've managed to develop a thriving community that has actually endured so much after 10 years of this new world. But in a lot of ways, it's also something that America can't keep going on with places like this, because it is just staying. It's not trying to rebuild anything. It's just staying for as long as possible. And I think it is why, as a narrative, you see James and Abigail departing Werewood as a good thing, because as much as they will have people who miss them at Werewood, you feel like they aren't doing anything, or they have nothing more they can do and no more room left to grow as people. If they stay here, they have to go out. But when the reader or the listener gets to Mary Samson and the people of New Athens, their departure feels a lot more uncertain. You don't have a feeling of certainty that they should stay, or that their decision to go is a sound one. As someone looking down on this story, you can't see that with as much sort of complete certainty that I know what the right thing is, because they aren't staying. These people aren't people who have stayed in one place and have just tried to do things. They have changed things. They took a town that was already there and changed it into something new. That is a form of advancement and progress, which James and Abigail, on a personal level, have not been able to do, and as part of the community they have developed into adults in, have not been able to do either. They are people who have grown into, you know, fine people. They're the heroes of our story. We connect with them, and the cartographers value them enough to recruit them into their number. But I will do this thing that I often do in these podcasts, which is re-examine the title and say they are keeping things back. They are keeping their own secrets, and the secret rooms may even be a sense of the parts of themselves that they've closed off.
No John Cena music here for the title drop, even though that's another part of our brand. I felt the subject matter was too serious to add wacky sound effects. But it's synchronicity that Toby uses the word arrested development here, because I had an interaction with Alex just the other day in response to thoughts that came up while preparing my Tiger's Eye outline. That story has a definite coming-of-age narrative, and my brain suddenly revisited secret rooms as a result. Is this also a coming-of-age narrative, if Abigail and James are suffering from arrested development? I asked this of Alex, and he reminded me that the author was dead as a doornail, and me and Toby should instead be telling them if that was the case. And on reflection, I would tentatively suggest that it is, though we'll get into that more on our final Secret Rooms episode. That said, I would add that Secret Rooms is only the beginning of that journey for our heroes. Steamheart is to James and Abby what the Winter Soldier is to Steve Rogers. For those of you that have been following along with the most recent audio drama, I can hear people ask, does this make Uncivil Outlaw the equivalent of Captain America Civil War? At which point I just stare at you, and then point at the cover of that particular book. Yeah. I can definitely see that. Again, as far as the title is concerned, why leave it to mean one thing when it can mean 12? on top of that, I was thinking a lot more about the importance of the three of theirs' connection during those early days. There was a space between the first flashback in the second that is about 4 months, and over the course of 14 through 17, there's another jump of about 3 months. And even when that first thing happens, where the three of them are split up and they are trying to figure out how to continue working, there is the hope that the three of them will eventually reconnect. The crux here is Lucy. You alluded to this earlier. Lucy is the connective tissue between Abigail and James. Lucy has the mind that's capable of working with the math and complex concepts that are so intrinsic to James's way of thinking, but she is also capable of the emotional maturity and depth that allows her to become closer to and intimate with Abigail. With Lucy present, the two of them might have been able to fuse these aspects together and become more whole people as a result by integrating the best parts of each of them into becoming adults.
She is the medium between them, and so they can cross over with her facilitating that.
Yeah, exactly. And when Lucy is gone, all they have left of themselves, and there is nobody else that is an adult or a more wiser influence that is going to help teach them how to be socialized, integrated people. Catherine is going to teach Abigail more about protecting herself and how to be a leader. Potts is going to teach James more on how to be a doctor and, you know, encourage his mind. But that is merely trying to add strength upon their already existing strengths.
Yeah, and they're teaching them to fill these roles, but they're not teaching them or helping them to be better versions of themselves, like a friend might, or the friends that they will grow to meet as they venture further out into the world. They are helping James be a doctor, and they're helping Abigail be a sort of strong leader and a fighter, but they aren't helping James come to terms with James, or Abigail to come to terms with Abigail. The loss of Lucy is so significant in that James and Abigail are this duo. They are a duality with each one representing opposite ends, these two extremes. But Lucy kind of had both of them gravitate towards her, and because of that, towards each other. Without Lucy as the point of magnetism for these two to draw towards one another, without her, they instead drift apart and just go further into their respective extremes, which makes the gulf between them that much harder to overcome, because the more time passes and the more they don't speak to one another, the more difficult it is to understand the other, because they haven't had this contact for so many years and they don't have a middle ground of someone who can speak to the part of them that they are unable to come to terms with.
Yeah, we played around a little bit with some of the psychological archetypes of Freud and Jung when considering these relationships, but the metaphor that I found the most striking is the idea that James and Abigail are left brain and right brain, and Lucy is there's a term for it, I don't remember what. There is literally connective tissue that allows the two sides of the brain to communicate with each other. For those curious, the connective fibers between neurons are called axons, but the network that connects left and right hemispheres is called the corpus callosum. And there's a really great video from CGP Grey that I will link to in the doobly-doo that talks about what happens when the corpus callosum is cut in a human brain. It's this video and what I learned from it that informed this next bit coming up. And when that tissue is gone, the way that the brain is able to interact with the body is significantly hampered, and actually implies that there are, in fact, two separate brains in your body that have two separate opinions on things based on the input that they're able to take in, because left brain has access to certain resources and right brain has access to certain resources. And if they can't talk to create a greater whole, then, you know, it definitely feels like that's the metaphor that Alex might be going for a little bit here. That feels like a good place to stop. So tune in next time for the thrilling conclusion of our thoughts on part 3 of Secret Rooms. To play us out is a pair of Georgia-based artists I've been waiting for a long time for an appropriate moment to use. It's partly a song about young love, but it's also got stuff in there about what it means to keep making the same mistakes over and over. The song was written about a real experience between a boy and a girl, but the artists themselves came out as lesbian later on. On top of that, some of the lyrics made me think of James, what with the comments about life should be solved by sticking the right formula in, or later, when the song comments about not being seen until I cease to exist. This feels like the perfect cocktail of ideas for this moment in the story. So until next time, this is the Indigo Girls, and their bittersweet hit, Least Complicated.
I sit two stories above the street. It's awful quiet, isn't love fell asleep? There's life down below me though. The kids are walking home from school. Some long ago when we were taught that for whatever kind of puzzle you got, you just stick the right formula. Solution for every fool. I remember the time when I came so close to you. Send me skipping my class and running from school. And I bought you that ring cause I never was cool. What makes me think I could start being slated? The hardest to learn was the least complicated. Two stories above the street. It's awful quiet here since love fell asleep. There's life down below me though. The kids are walking home from school.